What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Michael Phillips.
Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris.
Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman with some of the most familiar lines ever uttered on the silver screen. And those lines still pack a punch. But how does Casablanca itself hold up almost 75 years after its 1942 premiere?
Pretty well, actually.
Spoilers, Michael.
Pretty well, maybe.
That's better. This week, we'll walk into Bogey's Gin Joint for a Sacred Cow review of the Michael Curtiz-directed classic, plus your Film Spotting Madness Final Four and more ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting. Michael Phillips in for Josh Larson this week. It's so great to have you back on the show, Michael.
I'm up on the tall chair. You know, he's a tall man.
He is. And he is. But you're taller.
Am I taller than him?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, good. I like the perch.
You're
like
a formidable presence here in the studio, Michael. I'm not sure if you're aware, but there's this thing called college basketball.
Right.
It's going on right now.
Five per team. The basketball. Five on each side?
Yeah, okay. Five on five. This big basketball tournament, the big dance. Our congratulations to the men and women who are part of the final four teams competing for the title this weekend. Our own March Madness has entered the home stretch. We're going to be announcing the winners of last week's Elite Eight matchups, and I cannot wait to get Michael's thoughts, his interjections, his exclamations, his basically refusals to participate. I'm expecting to happen.
Well, I like any world where you can actually pit Vertigo up against The Empire Strikes Back because that makes
no sense at all.
No sense at all.
Well, just wait till you hear the winner. We've got Vertigo versus The Empire Strikes Back, Citizen Kane versus Kubrick's 2001, The Godfather Part II versus Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, and The Godfather, the first one, versus, yes, this week's Sacred Cow subject, Casablanca. Are you ready for the madness, Michael?
This is March insanity. It's not March madness. It's like a step beyond. It's a
fair
step
enough.
Beyond.
We'll get to all that later in the show, along with Michael's thoughts on Terrence Malick's Song to Song. But first, let's round up the usual suspects.
Well, you were asking about Rick, and here he is. Mademoiselle, may I present...
Hello,
Rick.
Oh, you've already met Rick, mademoiselle. Well, then perhaps you also...
This is Mr. Laszlo.
How do you do? How do you do? Well, here's a great deal about Rick in Casablanca and about Victor Laszlo everywhere. Won't you join us for a drink?
Oh, no, Rick.
Well, thanks, I will.
Well, a precedent is being broken. Emil?
This is a very interesting cafe. I congratulate you.
I congratulate you.
What for?
Your work?
Thank you.
I try. We all try. You succeed.
So anticipating the show we're going to do right now, Adam, about Casablanca and whether or not it's still the movie that it used to be for a lot of people, maybe still is for an awful lot of people. Last week, the Society for Cinema and Media Studies gathered in Chicago for its annual conference, and that is one hell of a lot of movie geeks in one town at one time, let me tell you. Hundreds of scholars, academics, specialists of all kinds, they gather, they give talks on every imaginable subject, and I caught a couple of them last week. One of them was called Complex Figures in Classic Hollywood, and it featured a film and literature professor from the University of Nevada, Reno, named Catherine Fusco. Well, Fusco gives this great 20-minute talk on Shirley Temple's profoundly disturbing early movie career in what were known as baby burlesques, these sort of precursors to Bugsy Malone, right? And this creepy and very kind of like bizarre sexual undercurrents, sort of astonishing stuff. Anybody with an interest in old Hollywood who can give you 20 new things in the space of 20 minutes to think about regarding Shirley Temple, subject I know nothing about, okay with me. So Adam and I are happy to have Catherine Fusco join us from Reno to talk about this question, this monument, this movie known as Casablanca. Catherine, thanks for being on.
Sure, I'm really happy to be here. Hi, Film Spotting.
Hello. Thank you, Catherine.
Okay, so Casablanca turns 75 this year, and it's either ageless or it's very much showing its age, depending on which pundit or film critic or cultural observer you're reading at the time. The Warner Brothers movie premiered in late 1942, but went into general release early 1943, and with the Allies, invading North Africa, the movie felt like the morning news right up there on the screen. Humphrey Bogart is the idealistic but cynical American hiding out in Morocco, goes from attractive isolationist, I stick my neck out for nobody, he says twice in the first 20 minutes, to committed, patriotic man of action. His love for Ingrid Bergman, who's hooked up with the resistance war hero played by Paul Henreid, is sacrificed for the greater good. This movie won the Oscar for Best Picture, and it is a lot of people's favorite Hollywood movie. Woody Allen wrote a play and later a movie called Play It Against Sam about a guy hopelessly measuring himself against Bogey's image. I mean, you look at Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, that's entirely devoted to Bogey. You got, you know, it's one of the most revered and satirized romantic dramas in cinema history. Several books have been written about Casablanca's place in the culture, and most recently that includes Noah Eisenberg's Will Always Have Casablanca. And yet, a lot of people think it's basically no longer ready for its close-up. In a recent Slate piece on the book and the film, Laura Miller notes that Sight and Sound magazine did a 2013 poll of the 50 greatest films of all time. Casablanca, directed by Michael Curtiz, did not make the cut. And she says this, "What's changed about Casablanca is the most powerful and intangible element in any work of popular culture, its ability to make each audience member feel this is about me, about who I am, but most of all, who I want to be." And she says this, too, "America still underestimates the degree to which the Second World War cast a long shadow over the last half of the 20th century. That shadow has mostly subsided, and the radiant dreams that consoled us as we walked through, while still worth revisiting, now seem less captivating and necessary," unquote. Adam, Catherine, we'll start with you, Catherine. Will we always have Casablanca, or is it sort of getting lost in the mists of time, the same mist we see Bogart and Claude Rains strolling through in the last few seconds of the film itself? So that's my question.
Oh, man.
We just have 20 seconds. We just have 20 seconds for you.
Shoot. You know, I was watching the film again yesterday to prepare, and I actually got a little nervous about being on the podcast. So I thought, oh, well, maybe I should just watch every kind of great classic film. So I rewatched Citizen Kane the day before. And, you know, I was thinking about that, you know, Kane as great, Casablanca as beloved kind of thing. And for me, I feel like Casablanca is this sort of gateway drug, but it's such a wonderful gateway drug, right? To kind of get people in. So, you know, I'm all about the gateway drug here, you know, whether it's not maybe as heady as Citizen Kane, right? It really just gives you that kind of gut punch. But I was also thinking about the sort of relevance now in the Laura Miller article, right? She's talking about how young men identified with this kind of cynic and less so with the more sincere Rick that we get by the end.
Huh.
And I was just thinking, man, you know, we could use a little sincerity and self-sacrifice now, right? We're sort of in this moment of, you know, the hot take where you kind of take the position that nobody else is taking and you're cynical and you kind of have your kind of anti-hero perspective. And I feel like we're kind of moving past that a little bit now. I don't know if it's a post-election moment or, we're kind of worn out on Tony Soprano or what. But I don't know. It feels fresh to me still.
Wait, did you see this film at a young age, Catherine?
You know, I saw it in college. And so I was thinking also about the sort of long shadow of World War II part of this retrospective essay. And I saw it the year before September 11th. So I was a 90s teen, and I grew up with a lot of the kind of flashy indie directors, right? So that was my initial film education as a teenager. I was watching, you know, Kevin Smith and Tarantino, and you know, that's what all of my really film educated friends were into. And then I had a friend in college who was into classical film, and we watched this film together, and I just felt like, oh man, there's this whole other world of film, you know, that's cool and affecting, right? And I think that's again, this, I really appreciate the non-cynical kind of nature of the film, right? Mm-hmm. That I guess, you know, after watching, right, I remember having the flu at some point in college and watching Natural Born Killers, right? This is sort of the antithesis of this, and it just felt really...
I would get the flu from that movie, that Oliver Stone
yeah,
movie.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, it was kind of, it blew our minds really to watch this movie and all of those famous lines that, you know, are in the culture. But it, as someone who grew up being able to rent videos and not having to rely on, you know, what was playing on TV, having access to these lines and sort of getting hit, bam, bam, bam. Oh, that's from this film too. That's from this film too. That's from this film too. I just sort of felt like something cracked open seeing this. So, yeah.
What about you, Adam? How early on did you bump into it?
Yeah, this is a perfect sacred
cow. And why are you wearing a fedora right now? That's what I want.
You know, I like to come in character. Okay. I saw this for the first time not until I was in college, when I was in film school. So it would have been actually the late 90s when I saw this movie for the first time. And this really is the ideal sort of scenario for one of these reviews, because watching it again just last night, actually, I realized I don't think I had seen it in the interim at all. Somehow I had never had an opportunity to see it. So I really am revisiting a film that is regarded as a classic and that I saw originally many years ago and loved, and it felt almost like I was watching it for the first time. And that's what we're usually going for here. And it's funny, I picked out the exact same two paragraphs from the Laura Miller Slate article as you did, Michael, the one about movies and a movie like this making you think most of all of who you want to be. And then her concluding statement where she says essentially that is no longer the case with this movie. It maybe no longer has that power. And she says it's still worth revisiting, but less captivating and necessary. Watching it again last night for me, I found it still as captivating as I did 20 years ago. I found it even more necessary, actually. Yeah. But we can get into that later. The other aspect of that, the first part, talking about every audience member feeling like this is about me or someone who I aspire to be, I made my kids watch this with me, my two oldest. So my son Holden just turned 15, and my daughter Sophie's about to be 13. Sophie was mostly kind of lost by all the maneuvering of the plot of the film.
The political stuff.
Yes, yeah. But my son Holden is this huge international diplomacy nerd. Those are the kind of games he plays, computer games and otherwise.
Was he saying things like, oh, yes, the Casablanca conference was right around that time.
Yes, he was, actually, Michael. And he's huge into geography, World War II in general. He's certainly not a connoisseur of classic cinema. He loved this movie. And I was sitting right next to him on the couch, and I was listening to him audibly react to all these great moments and lines that he, for the most part, was hearing for the first time. And at the end of it, he just said, everybody in that movie was so awesome.
Oh,
and I knew exactly what he meant, because that comment Laura Miller had about a lot of adolescent boys maybe taking immediately to Bogey and his gruffness and his toughness and how unflappable he seems at all times, except when he's around Ingrid Bergman's Ilsa. You know, that's something I think my son probably does sort of wish he had a little bit more in him, just as I do, actually, for that matter. And at the same time, he's this selfish rogue. He's charming, of course, and he's funny, and he's in control. And at his core, he's this idealist. And so I know that Holden was reacting to this figure that he admired in some way, but it wasn't just him. It was Claude Rains. It was Peter Lorre. It was Paul Henreid. It was Sidney Greenstreet. He was responding to the performances, of course. And a moment I'll single out that I know work for both of us is when we see Renaud's devilish little grin when he sees the Germans starting to sing about the fatherland. It's just like, these freaking guys, you know? And I just love that we get those kind of reactions. We get so many moments like that, wonderful faces throughout this whole film. But he really was invested in not just the plot, but just these characters and those lines of dialogue. And yes, he did discover that in one of his games, there's a badge or something that's called the Here's Looking at You Kid badge. Huh. Never understood it. Well, guess what? It's something you get when you go from like Portugal to Casablanca or vice versa. So that clicked for him. Huh. And it felt relevant to him, that's for sure. But it felt even more relevant to me for some of the political reasons that you touched on, Catherine. I think we can get into that a little bit
more. Yeah, I think the thing that I think is a little nutty about the Laura Miller piece in Slate is this idea that it's not, an admirable architect. There's nobody to kind of look up to and aspire to. And I think, especially, I can only speak as a high school age, you know, male in Racine, Wisconsin, probably seeing him for the first time when I was, I don't know, 14 or 15, probably on TV. And then I saw early date for me, you know, took my high school girlfriend, Sheila Hogan, up to Milwaukee to see a revival screening. This is like in 78, 79. And I mean, think of that. That's almost 40 years ago, and the film is turning 75. So, you know, it means it just lived in the culture for me in a way that it does not for even people who adore it, who are, you know, 10, 20, 25 years younger than me. It's just not the same.
I was wondering about that, though. I was looking this time at the moment we first see Bogart, and we see first a cigarette, right, and a cocktail, and then we see his face. And, you know, I've been sort of struggling with that last moment of the essay we're talking about where she says that this is less captivating and necessary. And I was just thinking, well, you know, what about Don Draper? Weren't there all these little kind of wannabe Don Drapers running around because people are really into the fact there's the smoking and the cocktail culture and all this stuff? And, you know, there's still that kind of, I guess, hipness, but, you know, it's much less shallow in some ways, right? This is a character, I don't know, who sort of has this history of goodness and the sacrifice that he gets into, right? So we get the kind of style and surface here. I think that still does feel, you know, pretty, you know, he seems pretty cool to me.
Yeah. I think there's a couple things that have been, one of the best things in that Laura Miller essay, and I don't want to talk about that too much, but I think she rightly so really dings Woody Allen's played against Sam Hard for including a line like, "I never saw a dame that didn't understand a good slap in the mouth or a slug from a 45. That's what the imaginary bogey says in that play. You know, Bogart never would have said a goddamn thing like that. I mean, that's a Mickey's.
You mean Rick?
Yeah, Rick.
Wouldn't say that. You're right.
Yeah. Anybody Bogart ever played, that is not, that line is Mickey Spillane or Mike Hammer. It has not got anything to do with Bogey or Casablanca. It just isn't. And one of the things, if anything, you can kind of look at Casablanca and say that the guy, you can argue that Rick is really mired in self-pity and you know, heartbreak. Mm-hmm. And that's, but to me, that's what makes this kind of glorious Hollywood schlock a little bit human. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a film I really love. At the same time, I understand completely why the Sight and Sound poll wouldn't make room for it in its top 50. I don't think I would either. It's just not, it's not the kind of classic that you look to for form, even though it's, for what it is, it's extremely adroitly made.
Yes.
And gorgeously cast. And there's, you know, there's a reason people go back to it, and a lot of it is the writing, which they were the story of how this thing barely got made, you know, rewriting every night and every morning and not even knowing who is going to end up with who by the end of it. You know, it gives the movie a kind of a peculiar tension, and I think you can feel it. It's kind of a meta thing going on where, you know, all these characters in Casablanca don't know if they're getting out in the narrative, and at the same time, the Epstein brothers and all the other folks working on the movie, you know, they didn't really know where they were going with this adaptation of an unproduced play. You know, they just didn't know. But it's a movie that it's a kind of classic, quote classic. You can show people that it's not an intimidating kind of, you know, it's more about comforting content and rather than challenging form, and therefore I think it's kind of the opposite of something like Citizen Kane, which is not trying to make you cry, is not trying to move you in a conventional way. You might find Kane fascinating and moving and all kinds of things, but it's not, I mean, they are completely different temperatures, these two films.
Yeah, Curtiz is definitely not trying to show his hand at work. And that said, Catherine, you mentioned the intro, our introduction to Bogey here. And Michael, you talk about maybe this isn't a movie that is drawing a lot of attention to its form, but the craft of it in terms of how the screenplay and the visuals work together. I think this movie has one of the all-time great setups and introductions to a character, because not only do we only see those parts of him first, but even before that happens, we see his name when the plane is flying
Rick's
in one of the
Cafe
first
American,
shots.
Yeah,
one of the first shots, we see his name. And so immediately we're kind of wondering, who is Rick and why is he being featured so prominently that early on? And then at least three or four times people talk about Rick before we even meet him. And there's all this talk about what, once we do finally meet him, there's all this talk about what would impress him, right? Ugarte talks about
that. He doesn't have a drink with anyone, right?
Yeah, so by the time we do meet him, we can't wait to finally see what this guy's all about. It's really heightened in that way. And then, as I said, when we do finally get to see him, he's someone who we know everyone else is in some way looking up to or trying to impress, and that makes us then revere him a little bit more, even as a character. I think another thing that stood out to me this time that I really liked is the way the Paul Henri character is, in a lot of ways, equal to Bogey. And I can just, I can speak for my son and say that he felt that way. Huh. Like, I mean, Bogey is still Bogey, don't get me wrong, right? And he's the star of the film. I'm sure everyone reveres him more. But he could have been played, Henri could have been played as this sort of bland, I'm going to probably get myself into trouble saying this around two historians such as yourselves, but a Ray Milland type character who maybe is kind of the straight guy, and he's meant to be the foil.
I think you're thinking more
cool
like Ralph Bellamy.
Okay, that's right. Who I am thinking of. Exactly.
Or Bob Cummings.
Maybe so. But here we have a guy who is someone who actually impresses Rick. Right? He impresses Rick. You see that every time they interact with each other. Nobody else does.
He's escaped from the concentration camp.
Right. He's truly brave. Yeah. He truly acts on his convictions. He's also good looking and smart and eloquent. And so what that does is that heightens that tension where we are legitimately torn, I think, as viewers in our allegiances. As much as we revere Bogey, it isn't just about who she's going to choose. It's about the conflict of knowing she could be great with both. Probably better off, as Bogey ultimately decides, with Victor. But I do feel like we're torn, partly because we see him as an equal to Rick in some ways. And the movie could have chosen another route.
You must know it's very important I get out of Casablanca. It's my privilege to be one of the leaders of a great movement. You know what I've been doing. You know what it means to the work, to the lives of thousands and thousands of people. I'll be free to reach America and continue my work.
I'm not interested in politics. The problems of the world are not in my department. I'm a saloon keeper.
My friends in the underground tell me that you've quite a record. You ran guns to Ethiopia. You fought against the fascists in Spain.
What of it?
Isn't it strange that you always happen to be fighting on the side of the underdog?
Yes, I found that a very expensive hobby, too, but then I never was much of a businessman.
Are you enough of a businessman to appreciate an offer of 100,000 francs?
I appreciate it, but I don't accept it.
I'll raise it to 200,000.
My friend, you could make it 1,000,000 francs or 3. My answer would still be the same.
There must be some reason why you won't let me have them.
There is. I suggest that you ask your wife.
I beg your pardon?
I said, ask your wife.
My wife?
Yes.
I think I disagree with you a little bit. This time through, I was feeling that the love triangle was really kind of weighted in one point a little bit this time. I wonder, you know, a lot of, as you were saying, of what we learn about people comes through dialogue that other people are speaking. And I was wondering, you know, I think so much of the respect that we feel for the Laszlo character comes through what other people say about him. I mean, for the longest time, I couldn't figure out, you know, what is this guy feel about his wife, you know?
No, that's valid.
So this time I felt that, I think, a little more strongly, that the weight of Rick versus Laszlo.
There is one other quick screenwriting thing I really like here that I picked up on this time is, we know why Ilsa left him at the train station. We figure it out because the screenplay gives us hints along the way before Rick figures it out. And I like that when the movie lets the audience sort of figure out something and then we're waiting for him to finally catch up to things a little bit. And it allows us also to see him as fallible. Like he's missing part of the story and he's wallowing in his self-pity, and that tempers the coolness of his character.
Yeah, without that, I think you got a very boring character. Mm-hmm. And Paul Henri hated making this movie. He thought he thought the Laszlo character was nothing but functionary and, you know, nothing much to play. But I think what I really noticed this time through, and I hadn't seen the movie front to back in many years, but I saw it the other day, and. I really do think the first 40, 45 minutes is kind of terrific Hollywood studio filmmaking. It's really crisp. I mean, Michael Curtiz has always been sort of a compelling A-minus director for me, you know, and I just sort of enjoyed things like, and this sounds totally wonky and like off narrative, but nobody could film a car doing pulling up at high speeds as the camera dollies in on a diagonal. I'm like, okay, Curtiz is always moving the camera in a dolly on a diagonal in a way that totally is dynamic. And you know, I love it when he's like zipping into a nightclub or just sort of dealing with backlot scenes of this sort of ersatz Casablanca. You know, I mean, it, you know, it's a lot closer to Van Nuys or Thousand Oaks than Casablanca, though, the whole kind of atmosphere of the picture. But it's sort of irresistible anyway. Now,
Van Nuys just doesn't have the ring to it, though.
No, it doesn't. No, I wouldn't have called it Van Nuys. No. But there's a close-up on Bergman when she finally gets...
Which one? There's so many great ones.
I know. when she finally gets Sam, the piano player played by Dooley Wilson, to play and sing As Time Goes By, right? The Herman Hupfeld song from 1931, which enjoyed this amazing resurgence after the film came out 12 years later. And it's a 26-second close-up with just the piano. And that, there's so many great things about that 26 seconds. A, Max Steiner's score, the musical score, finally has to shut the hell up and just let the piano do it. And Steiner's, you know, I love some of his stuff, but not a lot. And I think he's kind of always bigfooting the action. That's an amazing 26 seconds.
It is.
That, to me, that felt like, okay, I'm in, and I'm not in like watching it like in sort of a, you know, interested observer way. I just thought that feels completely fresh.
And right.
a lot of it's just her beauty, I suppose. But a lot of it's just everything else that's conspiring to make that moment great. Then there's a kind of a bookend shot where Bogart is drunk and he's, you know, drunkenly saying, you played it for her, you can play it for me, play it. And that shot is kind of a medium shot. And that's almost a full minute. It's 57 seconds. And then that sort of fades into the, you know, what a lot of people think is kind of one of the weaker 5 minutes of the picture, which is the Paris flashback, right?
Right.
But that minute of just a single shot where Bogart is sort of muttering a couple things incomprehensibly, that, again, is like, now this is screen acting, you know?
And that's
where you realize there are feelings at stake. And I think even in this sort of Hollywood fairy tale, and I don't want to diminish the film and I don't want to inflate it. I just sort of feel like if people don't know Casablanca, they just kind of need to find out for themselves where they land in it. And I, you know, if you happen to land on a in a position where you feel yourself, I don't really get the fuss. Well, welcome to my experience with It's a Wonderful Life every year. You know, I mean, you know, but Casablanca is not that for me. I found myself kind of newly falling into it happily, especially the first half.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is something a little progressively weaker about the film, although I adore the way it ends. And maybe it's just because some of the desperation with the screenwriting as they were writing on the fly. Maybe there's just one too many scenes where somebody pulls a gun and it's supposed to be a surprise and then it's a reversal and blah, blah, blah. But the first 45 minutes to me is absolutely irresistible popcorn.
Yeah. The last 30 minutes or so, Michael, I think I'm with you a little bit that you certainly become aware, or I did, that there's a real lack of stakes. The Nazis are never a threat in this movie, not even remotely. And I think maybe that's something that Hawks, when he did his version of this and To Have and Have Not, he improved on that one thing, which is actually making the Nazis a little bit scary and menacing.
Right. And even though Warners and Hal Wass were very forward progressive thinkers in terms of the Hollywood power structure about let's deal with what's actually happening in the war today.
Right.
Other people, it took them much longer to kind of embrace, you know, the sort of the anti-Nazi propaganda movement. And this is, you know, yes, this film in a way defines anti-Nazi propaganda films. But it does it in a way that, thank God, you know, transcends sort of the weaker stuff. And I mean, just a year before, Bogart did a film with John Huston, arguably a greater director, I think inarguably greater director at his best than Kertész, but, you know, called Across the Pacific, right? And that's a film that's, you know, pretty interesting and pretty fun. And then there's all this kind of cheap, you know, really kind of egregious, you know, anti-Japanese stereotyping, which, of course, was just rampant all through Hollywood for 3-4 years. And that film, it just isn't, it's instructive, I think, to see Across the Pacific kind of in relation to Casablanca, just to see how one is, you know, interesting for its time.
Mm-hmm.
One, you know, whether you love it or not, has happily transcended its time.
Yeah.
Do you think, Catherine, do you think it holds up like that?
Yeah, I was going to say, the middle, right, the sort of turning point, I wanted to kind of argue about just say a little about the stakes of the romance. One of the things that I really like about the style is one of those moments where the gun gets pulled, but when Ilsa pulls the gun on Rick, and one of the things that I think this film does that's really interesting is the stakes that it brings to the romance, right? That whole scene looks like it's straight out of a film noir, right?
It does.
I think there's even, you know, the Venetian blind kind of shadows across Ilsa's face at one moment. And you know, that the sort of violence that's all around these people, it heightens sort of the stakes of the romance. But I think there is that real sense of, you know, the violence in love that comes across here, right? That he has been devastated by her, that she, mm-hmm. you know, has this kind of painful, almost bodily need for forgiveness, right? And we get, you know, stylistically that feeling of danger there. And yeah, we get the gun pull at the end, but I think this film is good about kind of activating the violence that goes along with romantic betrayal and things like that.
Yeah. I think that's valid, and yet I did find myself this time feeling actually more suspense and worrying more about how that poor Bulgarian wife and her husband would end up than I did Rick and Ilsa, to be totally honest. I was more invested in that almost than I was how things were going to end up with this little love triangle. But I am curious, Catherine, for your thoughts on Bergman, because Michael talked there very eloquently, but to the surprise of this time, for me, were Bogey's vulnerability, and we touched on that mm-hmm. a little bit. I mean, I think that's one of the all-time great playing drunk scenes, honestly, yeah. and that close-up you talk about, but maybe Bogey didn't need much practice, and who knows, he might have been doing some actual method acting there, I suppose, in that scene, but it's great. And that vulnerability, I only remembered the Bogey that sort of gets shown, depicted in the Woody Allen movie, and it's much different than that, but for reasons I can't completely articulate, and maybe that's just what you chalk up to being movie magic, Bergman really is incredible here. And it's every longing close-up with that gauzy lighting and that one in particular that you focused on, Michael. But I just think that she ends up carrying the emotional weight of this movie on her shoulders. While everyone else gets all the snappy dialogue and they get all the entertaining stuff, she's actually saddled with most of the conflict and the internal struggle. And that last line, as much as I love the ending, watching it with a modern perspective, let's say, there is that last bit where he says, "Ilsa, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world." And then he adds, "Someday you'll understand that," which just seems to me this ultimate bit of mansplaining, right? It's back in the 40s.
It's important to end a great line with a totally patronizing
exactly.
quota.
And you know, I think that so much of it is understood as his sacrifice, but she's sort of being packed off with a man that I think it's clear she loves less, right? I mean, and I think we rarely frame the film in those terms, but I agree with you. I was watching her. I think it's when she goes, she's wearing this kind of great shirt and she's got this wrap around her waist and she strides into a room. And I was just thinking about the kind of energy which she enters that room to have her, you know, confrontation with Rick. I mean, she's going to confront him.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you about the way she carries the film.
Yeah, I think she is. But I did want to add that last line. By that last right. line, I kind of wanted her to say back to Bogey, "Wait, I'm the one who needs perspective here." I mean, she right. lost her husband to the Holocaust, thought he right. died, went through all that grief and heartbreak, moved on, found happiness, only to go through more heartbreak. And now right. she's fully committed to him and the cause, despite whatever suffering that may cause her. But she's the one who somehow needs to understand the consequence of all this in the world.
This is where you really kind of, I think, feel the mechanics of
right.
desperate screenwriting at work. I mean, you know what I mean? Where you just feel whatever the need was, or the perceived need to have a line like that, or you know, there's a very fine line, I think, that separates the wonderful individual lines, often quoted, endlessly quoted lines from Casablanca from the ones you don't, you know, and it's just, right. I mean, it's all the same people writing them, but it's, you know, it happens. I think one thing that you talked about this earlier, Catherine, when I saw this film, really saw it for the first time in high school back in the 70s, it really came as kind of this completely bracing antidote to all the cynical 70s mm-hmm. era stuff I had been seeing my whole, you know, young movie going life. I mean, everything from, you know, I saw a movie like The Long Goodbye, Altman's film, which is essentially, you know, it's basically kind of making fun of the Bogart image, mm-hmm. the way Elliot Gould's playing Philip Marlowe, when Bogart played Marlowe, obviously, in The Big Sleep. But, you know, it's like I saw all the really kind of rancid, sour, disillusioned stuff after or before I saw where it all was coming from, which is Casablanca. And is it a guy's movie? Is it a boy? Is it kind of a boy's life fantasy? Yeah, it is. It is. And it's also kind of the attractive American male loner you know, he's really kind of the moral compass and the savior and the hero and all that. And yet, I think it's kind of crazy to not look at that and say, you know, actually, as you know, you have a more, at least that character starts from at a point A and gets to point B or C by the end. It is not simply a stalwart, boring American action hero. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a guy who, you know, it's as you say, it's, you know, he's an idealist. He's kind of a failed idealist at the beginning. And, you know, you hear whispers about what brought him to Casablanca and why did he actually have to leave America. You never really learn too many details. And you never even find out why he won't be let back into the country, into the U.S. But you get, I think you get notions, you know, however kind of hamily treated, notions of, you know, self-sacrifice and doing the right thing and all that and mansplaining, absolutely.
A little bit of that.
But it's distributed, though. I mean, if you want to talk about those Bulgarians, right, the Bulgarian young woman, right, they're Bulgarian, right? Mm-hmm. Right, you see her really kind of taking charge. I mean, if you want to talk about an uneven love triangle, right, the triangle between her and Renaud, and there's this kind of confused husband who's off losing money at the roulette wheel or whatever he's doing, right? But she's really taking charge in that relationship.
Yeah.
And you can sort of imagine a world in which that's Ilsa, I think.
No, that's a great point.
And they had to dance around that a little bit because the Hays code the Hays office wouldn't let him spell it out too clearly that Renaud is basically
saying,
saying, sleep with me and I'll give you the letters of transit. A completely fictional construct, by the way. There was no such thing as, quote, letters of transit in this
period.
And the screenwriters kept waiting for them to be kind of found out and called on the cover for it. Nobody did.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we want to push the comparison too far, but going back to what we started with, talking about relevancy or timeliness, this movie in 1998, when I saw it, I appreciated it purely as this piece of entertainment and art that I was considering and having to write a paper about and all those things. But watching it now, when you see and hear all the talk of refugees and the sacrifices, speaking of that Bulgarian couple they have to make in search of a better life, and talk of travel permits and people being detained and questioned, and of a country isolating itself from the rest of the world and of a resistance to tyranny, it can't help but feel a little bit of this time right now. And even more than that for me is, Michael, what we talked about when we did our show, the live show post-election, where we shared our top five movies to console and restore hope. And what I kind of argued there was that consolation isn't enough. Hope isn't enough. Hope really comes from action. And if you're dissatisfied now with our leadership or whatever the message we're sending to the rest of the world, you can either be Rick or you can be Renaud and accept that this is the way the world works and kind of cynically just go ahead with your life or even try to exploit it in some way for your own gain. Or you can actually stick your neck out for somebody instead of nobody. And I think the value of that message and the vitality of that message is probably heightened for certain generations versus others. And we're in one of those times right now, but it's also that type of message that I think every generation probably could find its own core.
Totally. And this film, like a lot of great Hollywood successes, let's say, is you can read it any way you like. And the politics and the ideology is there if you want it. I guarantee that in 1943... you know, a lot of Americans were probably still not. I mean, they were suddenly very not. You know, kind of like immediately struck by the horrors of what it means to send off a son or a husband or whatever to war, and they were very conflicted about it. Even though there was no looking back, but I think today, you know, you get when you have a president who really is literally rounding up the usual suspects all the time, and it's not a laugh line like it is when Claude Rains says it. You know, this is. I agree. I mean, what struck me this time watching Casablanca was that the film and Rick, as played by Bogart, it's really just a parallel for America kind of blithely not wanting to get into it and then realizing, you know, it's the right thing to do. Let's get in there. And, you know, I think today, when as you say, Adam, so eloquently, really, very eloquently, no, truly, I mean, it's a film that forces you to kind of reckon with this question of, you know, luck and happenstance and who and where you were born and the time you were born in and who's what government you're sort of, you know, you know, at the whim of. And I think that's why the movie works. I think it's got this compression, even though it's complete Hollywood fakery. It's backlot Morocco, you know. But but the casting is what makes it feel authentic. You have, you know, out of this entire speaking cast, there are three American-born actors. That is it. Everybody else came from somewhere else. And a lot of these folks were literal war refugees, as we know.
They're coming because the war is coming.
Absolutely. SZ Sakal lost, you know, family members in the Holocaust who play, you know, any number of these supporting character actors. You know, they're from Austria, Germany, France, all of them. And that's why the movie doesn't just feel like a Hollywood product. It feels like it's a Hollywood product, but it's got a flavor all its own.
Yes. Backlot Morocco, by the way, the name of my high school band. So, Catherine Fusco teaches at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her recent book is called Silent Film and U.S. Naturalist Literature. Catherine, anything else you want to plug? Any more information about where our listeners can find your work?
Sure. So I will have a book coming out with my friend Nicole Seymour about Kelly Reichardt in the next year. And you can follow me on Twitter at Fusco Writes.
Reichardt, one of our favorites here on Film Spotting, so we'll definitely have to have you back on when that book comes out. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great talking with you, Catherine.
Good to talk to you.
It might be a good idea for you to disappear from Casablanca for a while. There's a free French garrison over at Brazzaville. I could be induced to arrange a passage.
My letter of transit? I could use a trip. But it doesn't make any difference about our bet. You still owe me 10,000 francs.
And that 10,000 francs should pay our expenses.
Our expenses? Louis? I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Casablanca is available to rent on most platforms. If you've seen it, and if you haven't, well, you really need to get out there and see it, and you agree or disagree with our thoughts on it, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Michael, we do have another Sacred Cow review planned for the next couple weeks. Josh is going to be off at Ebert Interruptus in Colorado, and he's interrupting the movie Rushmore, Wes Anderson. So we thought actually maybe the night after he does that, he could call into the show, and we'll do a little Sacred Cow on Rushmore, and we'll see if he learned anything going through it frame by painstaking frame.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Good. So we agree that Casablanca is at least worth a debate.
Absolutely.
An argument. And and I don't think it's dead yet.
No. You know?
But how did it fare in its Film Spotting Madness Elite Eight matchup against The Godfather?
I mean, now we're getting to the real stakes.
Yes, The Godfather. Those results are next. Stay with us.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely.
I never thought I would live long. You know, I'd be an artist and die young of tuberculosis or something like Charlotte Bronte.
I but, think that you do.
Just gotten involved with this man who I thought could help me. And
you made a mistake, you know. You,
do you look at it
as you're fine?
Rock icon Patti Smith sharing some well-earned wisdom with Rooney Mara and Terrence Malick's latest song to song. This movie we were planning on giving a full review to, actually kind of what inspired talking about Casablanca this week, because both are love triangle movies, though we'll see if love triangle is really an accurate description for this film. Can you sum up a Terrence Malick film with any phrases?
This one's more of a rhombus. I don't know what a romantic rhombus would be.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah, but I failed. In my diligence, Michael, as I so often do here on the show, I ended up doing something unthinkable, spending time with my family this weekend. We had a little getaway, and I didn't make it to Song to Song. You, the consummate professional,
Adam,
you saw
it. There's no money in that.
No, you're right.
There's no money in spending time with you. What do you think?
But we were both, frankly, kind of dreading this movie. Talking behind the scenes, because we haven't been big fans of the last two Malick joints, To the Wonder.
I don't remember us talking behind the scenes. I remember us murmuring in voiceover.
We were murmuring in voiceover
behind the scenes. And then the camera, oddly, just sort of drifted over to long shots of tall grass. in the breeze.
As it occasionally
does. I know. Look, it's so easy to... It's too easy to make fun of Terrence Malick as a tick-ridden stylist. You know what I mean? I mean, we can all think of the things that might drive us a little crazy about his visual preoccupations mm-hmm. and his, his poetic meditations on kind of just the planet, the ravagements of nature, the spaces between the lines, which, you know, most screenwriter directors would actually have people talk about things in real time using their mouths rather than just sort of the interior thought processes, mm-hmm. which is Malick's, you know, chosen mode, and that continues in song to song, even though you have kind of a convention. You could make a conventional movie if you wanted to out of, you know, Michael Fassbender playing this kind of, you know, this big deal music mogul down in Austin, Texas. Ryan Gosling plays the songwriter who's under his wing and kind of a friend, but also a romantic rival, because Rooney Mara is this kind of vaguely defined singer-songwriter who's Gosling's girlfriend, but she ends up in Fassbender's bed. And, you know, she's...
As one does.
Speak for yourself. But you know, Natalie Portman shows up as a waitress who also lands in Fassbender's lap. And, you know, people just sort of come and go. And the film didn't make me despair the way Knight of Cups did.
Okay.
I mean, to me, that's the lowest of the low for Malick, for the dead end.
Mm.
And the film I got the least out of. And for a lot of people, Song of Songs was worse. And it got derisively received at South by Southwest down in Austin. And I wasn't there for that. But, you know, there are moments in Song to Song where I thought, yeah, there it is again. You know, just when you're fully giving up on the guy and you've had it with these stylistic preoccupations and all the rest of it, he and Emmanuel Lubezki put together a shot that is just like a kind of a good, it's not just gorgeous in a pretty picture way. It's actually kind of a heart stopper, you know, really kind of catches and kind of catches a character in a moment of reflection, silent in one way, but voice overing in another. But then sort of like, you know, you get kind of the corollary with a non-human sort of camera subject, some sort of piece of the earth or the grass or something or the river, whatever. And it actually works as momentary screen poetry. This only mm-hmm. happens occasionally in Song to Song.
And it used to happen all the time.
You know, you go back to how Days of Heaven was completely shot and in a rough way anyway, completed. Malick takes a look at it, hates it, throws it out, starts over, and then you get almost a completely different film that is now a miracle of concision because it's 85, 88 minutes long, whatever Days of Heaven is. And, you know, that's obviously dependent heavily on Linda Manson's voiceover as, you know, the teenager, or actually she's not even a teenager, I think, right? In Days of Heaven? I don't know how old.
Yeah, it's hard to say because she's kind of right on the cusp, it seems to me.
Yeah. But it's, you know, that film to me is, he's always going to be kind of fighting that one. But even as late as, Adam, I don't know how you feel about The New World, whatever version you've seen.
I actually have The New World ranked ahead of Days of Heaven.
You do.
On my Terrence Malick list.
You love it.
I do.
It. Yeah. I love about half of that. And look, I don't really care about the half I don't, because he is working. He is marching to his own drummer. Mm-hmm. And I always say he gets caught in the narrative weeds every time, and then he just films the weeds, you know. And you know what? Anybody can do conventional narrative. He shouldn't.
Absolutely.
He shouldn't. But I just get the feeling that he's about to enter a new phase.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether it's very different than the one we're currently, I think, near the end of, we'll mm-hmm. see. But, you know, I don't know. Can I recommend it? I don't know.
Right.
I don't have to. It's a podcast. I don't have to give you a star
you don't.
Rating.
No.
This isn't the Tribune, for God's sake.
I'm not going to force one
okay,
on you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Song to Song is out in limited release. If you see it, we don't want your star rating. We want your engagement. We want your ideas. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. I will forward all of the emails telling Michael that he's not appreciative enough of Malick's genius. Write to him. He'll read them.
I'll read them out loud. In voiceover.
In voiceover, of course. One note for our Chicago area listeners here. We do have advanced screening passes to the movie Gifted. This stars Chris Evans. He plays a single dad raising his math prodigy daughter. It opens wide on April 7th, and there's going to be an advanced screening here on Monday, April the 3rd at AMC River East. More information about how to enter to see that movie before it opens at filmspotting.net. And Michael, we also wanted to give a quick shout out to Madison, Wisconsin's low-powered radio station, WMUU. It airs Film Spotting every weekend. Now, you're a guy from Kenosha?
Yes. Born in Kenosha, raised in Racine.
Okay. Yes. Raised in Racine.
Yes.
What's the jaunt, Racine to Madison?
About 2 hours.
About 2 hours. That's not much at all. The station's co-founder, Kelly Warren, dropped us a note and said that she would love it if we could help spread the word about the Wisconsin Film Festival. It opens this weekend and runs through April 6th. At screens all over Madison. Hmm. We will link to more information about WMUU and the Film Fest in the notes for the show at filmspotting.net. And we give our thanks to Kelly for the note and for playing Film Spotting every week.
Oh, Scotty. I'm not mad. I don't want to die. There's someone within me, and she says I must die. Oh, Scotty, don't let me go.
I'm here. I've got you.
Okay, let's get to the madness. I can't wait to drop Michael right into this heart of darkness. We started with 64 films, 65 actually. We had a play-in match. Only one of these films can reign supreme. We took all of our Pantheon films here at Film Spotting and our Sacred Cows. So, Michael, if Casablanca wasn't already in the Pantheon, it would now be eligible because it's been given the Sacred Cow treatment. We put all those films together, and if you really want details on the hows and the whys, all these films are included in the tournament. You can listen to episode 624 or visit the Pantheon page under top fives at filmspotting.net. A quick reminder about the timing of voting, because we're getting down here to the final four. We will always post a new poll, the new contestants, late Thursday at midnight. So actually Wednesday night, Thursday morning, and the polls close Mondays at 5 p.m. So you have about 4 days to get your vote in. And Michael, we're going to get to the matchups and the results. Thousands of votes. Once again, we're going to start with the widest margin of victory and going down to the narrowest, though this time they were all pretty narrow, which I suppose makes sense.
Really?
As you're getting down to the final eight films. You'd expect that people would have maybe a tough time. And we'll get to a couple upsets as well.
Well, let's hear it.
Matchup number one, The Godfather versus, there it is, Casablanca. Let's hear how those films got to this round.
So The Godfather beat that other great mafioso classic, Young Frankenstein, in round one. It also beat Before Sunrise, Richard Linklater's great mafioso classic, in round two. And then in round three, it beat Ridley Scott's extraterrestrial mafioso classic, Alien, in round three. So that's how The Godfather beat all those films, Young Frankenstein, Before Sunrise, and Alien.
Yes, and Casablanca beat Edward Scissorhands. No mobsters in that film, as far as I remember. Blue Velvet does have a mobster. I think we can say that Frank Booth is a bit of a mobster.
He would take care of business.
He would,
indeed. In the world of The Godfather.
Yes.
You know.
I'd like to see that movie.
Tessio would have died a lot sooner.
So true. Taxi Driver in round three, Martin Scorsese's classic. We heard from longtime listener, the Reverend Robert Lewis, who said, if Godfather wins and you didn't vote for Casablanca, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
Zach Ford says, in a bracket left with cold movies following the acts of antiheroes, my vote goes for the remaining movie with the most genuine warmth and humanity. In this harsh world, there is enough crime, suspicion, and corporate greed. What we truly need now is Paris.
Well, Patrick Najjar disagrees. Rick and Ilsa can have Paris. This tournament belongs to the Corleones. And Michael, that is how it came out.
That's how it came out.
The Godfather taking down Casablanca 59% to 41%.
Wow.
How do you feel about that?
Huh. You know, I think it's tragic. But I love The Godfather, not as much as I love The Godfather Part Two.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say.
Perfect transition. Our second matchup here is The Godfather Part Two versus Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
The Godfather Part Two took down In America in round one, The Big Lebowski in round two, and Star Wars in round three.
And Pulp Fiction beat Cool Hand Luke in round one, Rio Bravo in round two, and Goodfellas, a related picture, actually,
yes,
in round three.
How about that? Cool Hand Luke, Rio Bravo, and Goodfellas. Those are three pretty good films.
I like them. And I think it also beat out A Bowl of Grapes. You know, an unrelated competition.
It definitely did.
Yeah.
Aaron in Washington, D.C. says, hey, everyone, they made a mistake. Goodfellas, you won round three. This is not a joke. I'm afraid they wrote the wrong thing. Goodfellas, best of round three.
John,
nice try.
John Owen says, this was the hardest choice this round. So hard that I had to flip a coin. Heads, Godfather 2. Tails, Pulp Fiction. It came up tails, and the stab of pain in my heart at the thought of losing Godfather 2 made me break my own rule. I love both, but Godfather 2 is so rich with texture, beauty, ugliness, elation, depression, I just can't live without it. And if I could somehow hide Pulp Fiction in some orifice somewhere for the duration of the tournament, I would gladly do so.
See, you had to do that in your walk-in voice.
I know. I'm sorry that John had to write that.
Me too.
Yeah.
But I admire his conviction.
He had to.
Todd Castle, damn you, Film Spotting Madness, damn you. I've been able to make my picks throughout this tournament without pause, every single one. And then you gave me this. My three favorite movies of all time are Apocalypse Now, The Godfather 2, and Pulp Fiction. Each time I watch one, I nod my head contentedly and say, yep, that's my favorite. That's it. I last watched Godfather 2. I guess it's time to pop in Pulp Fiction, because after a long, long pause, that's what I picked. Damn you. And so did Michael, the majority of our listeners. And here's where you never come back on Film Spotting. Yeah. The Godfather Part II, the number two overall seed in this tournament, goes down to Pulp Fiction, 53% to 47%.
Pulp Fiction is just, it is a major milestone in an awful lot of movie lovers' lives. It really is. And I admire it a lot and I enjoy it a lot. I haven't seen the whole thing in a long time.
Really?
I sure as hell don't put it anywhere near The Godfather 2. But it remains one of Tarantino's two or three best.
Yeah, I'm with you there, certainly.
Yeah, it's still a stupid upset.
Okay, well, I am really
curious. The whole thing is stupid.
Yeah, well, yes, we know that.
I actually think between Pulp Fiction and A Bowl of Grapes, that would be a close one for me.
Really?
Yeah, I love grapes.
Well, I'm with you.
And I like Pulp Fiction.
Green or the purple grapes?
I'm purple.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I am very curious to hear your response to this matchup. Two all-time classics. One discussed by you here on this show in a Sacred Cow review. That was 2001, A Space Odyssey versus the higher-seeded, you know, Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane beat Born on the 4th of July,
right.
Jaws, and another Spielberg Raiders of the Lost Ark to get here.
And 2001 beat To Kill a Mockingbird, Do the Right Thing, and Back to the Future. This is an interesting...
It is. Nick Colucci in Buffalo says, 2001 over Back to the Future, Kane over Raiders, Godfather 2 over Star Wars. I've been listening to Film Spotting for around 2 months now, so this is my first experience with madness and the opinions of my fellow Film Spotting fans. After the three results listed above from the Sweet 16, I have only one thing to say to everyone. Y'all is boring. Guilty?
This from a guy from Buffalo. Anyway, Brett Merriman in L.A. I can't dog Buffalo.
No.
I shouldn't dog Buffalo. Brett Merriman in L.A. says, I have to put on my big boy pants for this one. For all the people who think these two are boring or like eating your vegetables, take a moment to consider the narratives. One begins with the hero's death, tells his story through a newsreel, then goes nonlinear to retell his story through interviews and flashbacks. The other one has no central character and instead uses four distinct events to chart the evolution of mankind. These two films are more complex and ambitious than 99% of what gets made today. There's a reason we all look to the past for cinema's greats, because unfortunately, that's where they mostly are. All hail Wells, all hail Kubrick, and the winner is 2001.
Wow. Mm. It's almost like Brett has written a screenplay before. Lucas in Sweden, when I was in my mid-teens, I'm 23 now, me and my friends used to arrange our own marathons where we stayed up all night watching mostly bad movies and eating delicious Swedish candy. We were clearly too cool for parties. One night, the theme was old sci-fi film. We popped in 2001, and we did not utter a single word during the next 161 minutes. I don't even think I touched the candy. Completely horrified, but also fully mesmerized. Up until this moment in my life, I had never thought of movies as more than entertainment. 2001 opened up a whole new world for me. The next day, I saw it again, and again the day after that. It probably took me 5 viewings to realize that I liked the damn thing, and another 5 to realize that I loved it. It was like Kubrick had walked into my brain and turned on the switch that said, film has an artistic value. I owe everything to Kubrick in 2001 for doing that to me, and the least I can do is to help it win this championship.
Zachary Cook in Chicago says, I think we're missing an angle here. All existing movies will be abolished after this tournament, but in this charred celluloid hellscape, will Hollywood be allowed to rebuild? Will new movies be allowed to sprout Wall-E-like from the refuse? If so, what movie do you want to exist to guide future film pioneers? Imagine a world where 2001 is the existing film Bible versus Citizen Kane. Kane, to me, is clearly the better blueprint, technically and culturally, to rebuild around.
Zachary has blown my mind. He's actually posited a question that the creators of this bracket, myself and our esteemed producer, Sam Van Halgren, did not consider. I don't know if more movies get to be made or not. We're going to have to weigh in on that.
Yeah.
I think the committee will have to have a very long, drawn-out
discussion.
He's got
his own franchise going, Zach.
Yeah.
You know?
Christopher Redman, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here, people. Kane is the monolith to which all other films should bow before, even if it means beating each other over the heads with bones of other films to get there.
I love that. It's good.
And unfortunately for Christopher and others, Kane goes down. It is beaten by those bones. 47% for Kane, 53% for 2001. You can't feel too bad about it because it's 2001.
It's 2001. It's Kubrick's last truly great film, I think. I still feel bad about it.
Well, that's the point.
You know, Citizen Kane to me is, you know, no less than 2001. And this sounds crazy, but it has the power to disorient young audiences seeing it for the first time, no less than 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've showed it to classes, undergraduates, and that tricky structure, and more importantly with Kane, I think that absolutely unique kind of flavor and tone, that chill, that simultaneously kind of delight in technique, but also kind of a, you know, that sort of bittersweet chill that runs through it. I don't know. People look at it as like it's as strange an artifact as 2001, and I think in a funny way they're kind of talking to each other, these two films. I feel, incorrect pick on the madness.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're going to have those feelings as well.
I'm going to have those feelings.
Final matchup.
Oh, I'm going to have those feelings. Okay. Oh, okay. Fine. Oh, I'm sorry.
Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo versus The Empire Strikes Back. Vertigo beats Say Anything, Annie Hall, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I picked Annie Hall, by the way, Michael. Sorry.
Okay.
Empire beat A Nightmare on Elm Street, the original. Singing in the Rain and Apocalypse Now.
What?
So, I mean, after Nightmare, it had a very tough route.
Singing in the Rain?
I know. I know.
Okay, here's Trevor Wallace in Queens. Hey, I get the anti-Star Wars backlash. I really do. In the end, they are silly space fantasy movies with magic and lasers and bad guys and fabulous capes. I will also admit us diehard fans can be incredibly obnoxious in our love, especially for Empire Strikes Back, in an attempt to legitimize our lifelong love for a franchise really made for children. I actually agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Vertigo is a film for adults working in complex and subtle themes, exploring the limits of film form and function. If you need to vote for that sort of film, I'm not going to argue. But The Empire Strikes Back is why I see movies. It bursts at the seams from a wealth of imagination. It washes over you with a sense of adventure. It's tense and funny and exciting and sad. Does that make me a bit of a popcorn-munching populist? Probably, but I embrace it.
That hurt you, Michael. I know. I know it did.
I mean, I love Empire, the best of any of the Star Wars, but keep going.
Well, Anthony Miglieri in Muncie, Indiana told us, as much as I wholeheartedly believe in the masterpiece-dom of Empire, a fairer matchup for me would have been The Empire Strikes Back versus the opening title sequence of Vertigo. Even then, I don't know, man, Saul Bass makes some pretty sweet swirlies. And
yes.
Christopher Redman again says, critics love Hitchcock and Vertigo is quintessential Hitch. Audiences love Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back is the best of the bunch, but neither film works as well or resonates as deep outside the respective cinematic universes. So don't get dizzy over this vote. Both are doomed in the next round.
Doomed. Wow, he's
maybe
talking,
so.
Talking like the Star Child. Aaron Teachman in D.C., so much of film spotting is a balance of big C culture versus little C culture. And one of the things I admire most about the show is that films like Die Hard, Out of Sight, Midnight Run, and Empire Strikes Back are treated as equals with the Citizen Kanes and the Vertigos of the cinematic universe. Is that true, Adam? Because I'm not staying around.
That's mostly
accurate. I'm not staying here. This Pantheon Madness tournament is utterly shot through with these big C versus little C matchups with all the topsy-turvydom that brings. I'm sorry for Hitchcock, but if I'm not choosing a film that I would drop whatever I was doing to watch, what's the point? I appreciate Vertigo, but I'm not interrupting a lazy Sunday to finish it. I'm tempted to watch Empire, even as I'm typing this, even the revisionist one. I'm writing Empire as far as the Falcon will take me.
Okay, well, we've got a rebuttal here, Aaron. It comes in the form of a voicemail from Chris Moody. He's in Tetbury, Gloucestershire, England, and I suppose we'll say maybe you should throw on some earmuffs if you're easily offended.
This has to stop. Star Wars took out Cuckoo's Nest, Empire's taken out Singing in the Rain, and Apocalypse Now. If I'm honest, I'd take any of those three films over Vertigo. But, to quote my good friend Don Logan, not this time, gal, not this time, not this time, no! No, 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 no! No! No, 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 no! No! Not this time! No way! No way! No way! No way! You've made me look a right Vertigo, please.
Our thanks to Chris, and for the uninitiated, yes, Chris was doing a little masquer theater duty this week with a very respectable Don Logan from Sexy Beast. I think Ben Kingsley needs to watch his back.
He's finished.
That brings us to the results. And Michael, I don't know how to prepare you for this, but you probably knew it was going to happen. The Empire Strikes Back beats Vertigo 55% to 45%. Technically an upset, though. I think it probably wasn't that much of a surprise that Empire won out.
I'm going to look on the bright side. I'm an optimist, you know? I mean, I'm just pleased that it's The Empire Strikes Back we're talking about here beating Vertigo. Ridiculous, of course. Mm-hmm. But instead of the first Star Wars.
Okay.
Empire's a far more interesting movie.
I agree with you.
And fiddle-dee-dee to Hitchcock. That hack.
Exactly.
Never made a space movie.
Nope, he didn't.
Stupid director is he? Okay.
Your final four, then. The Godfather. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Pulp Fiction. And The Empire Strikes Back. Before we get to the new matchups, then, we do have to take a moment to look at our bracket predictions. Me, Josh, Sam, and Mike Merrigan, who was the person who initially came up with the concept of Film Spotting Madness, longtime listener in Dover, New Hampshire. We try to predict how it's all going to play out, and we have a little competition where whoever loses has to suffer through the embarrassment, I suppose, first, and then second, they have to watch a really terrible movie. And we haven't actually decided what that movie is going to be yet. But
Police Academy, Mission to Moscow.
Mission to Moscow. That's a good one. Maybe we'll go with that.
Yeah,
last year, Josh had to watch The Ridiculous Six, Adam Sandler. That straight to Netflix thing?
I saw that.
Did you?
Yeah, I had to review that. Jeez.
Okay. Well, we'll see if it's Police Academy or something else, as we do need to settle on that. And it could happen. It could be Josh again. He right now is in last place, 70 points. He got only one of the final four correct. But as I'll explain here in a moment, he could still win, oddly enough. I'm in second to last place, 76 points. I also got only one of the final four correct. And somehow I, too, could win this whole thing. Mike is in second overall, 82 points. He also only got one of four correct. And worth noting, all three of us picked different films that actually made it to the final four. Now, Sam, he's running away with it. 97 points, correctly predicted two of the final four. But here's the thing. It's not in the bag just yet. Mike, he can't win because he thought Jaws was going to win it all. And Jaws has been out for a little while. But Mike can't lose either. Because of where he stands, he can't lose. What this means is, let me break it down. One film spotting host could win. If somehow the film we pick for the final four manages to win it all, there's still a possibility we could win it. But one film spotting host definitely will lose. It's going to be me or Josh watching Police Academy 5 or 6 or 7.
Yeah, Mission to Moscow. I forget which number that was. Not that I've ever seen it.
No, of course not.
But I always think every sequel in every franchise, whether it's The Avengers or Star Wars, should eventually just get to, like, Mission to Moscow.
Mission to Moscow.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, Sam did bring something up offline that I had to consider a few weeks ago, which was this whole bracket, the seeding, was determined by me and Sam based on how we thought the tournament would play out.
Hmm.
And yet somehow when I filled out my bracket, I totally ignored all of that and tried to go with more unconventional choices. I had Eternal Sunshine in my final four.
Yeah.
I thought that's how our listeners might go. I was thinking about that younger, hipper crowd.
Well,
it's like
a metaphor for parenthood. You make plans stupidly, and none of them will be followed.
And then you don't follow them.
You just have to be responsive to the needs at hand.
There you go. And now I may lose Film Spotting Madness. The final four matchups are, Michael, do the honors.
Okay, The Godfather versus 2001, A Space Odyssey. Pulp Fiction versus The Empire Strikes Back. Wow.
Are you going to give us your vote? Godfather versus 2001?
2001.
Wow. This is so hard because I'd really love 2001 to win it.
Yeah.
I'd love it to win it all.
Yeah, me too.
But
I care about that matchup. I care a little less about the next one.
I can't vote in either of these. I can't vote for either of them. I'm not going to do it.
Which one?
You can't force me.
Okay.
Neither matchup. I'm not voting.
It's just your...
I can't do it. I can't pick The Godfather over 2001. If I had to, and I have to. It's so boring, but The Godfather.
Oh, no.
I can just watch it and watch it and watch it.
Yeah.
And watch it.
But
I can.
The second one's better, though.
I agree with you.
I know. Then modulate your opinion. Oh, okay.
Pulp Fiction versus The Empire Strikes Back.
What do I think?
What do you think?
Pulp Fiction, probably. I just, on some level, I will always be a little like, you know, Lucas wanted to make Flash Gordon, couldn't get the rights, and then he came up with this instead, and he did, you know, he got lucky. And some of them are pretty good. I mean, this one's really good.
It is.
Empire. Pulp Fiction, you know, Tarantino's been sort of like fighting the reputation and, you know, trying to keep the standards up ever since, and I don't know. All it is Pulp Fiction, but it's great fun.
I think that's where I'm leaning right now.
Really?
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, me too.
All right. We want to know what you think, though. Play now at filmspottingmadness.com, or you can look for the link in the show notes at our website, filmspotting.net, at filmspottingmadness.com. That's where you can see all the matchups, vote, as I mentioned, and you can see the whole bracket and how everything has played out and how it could play out. Still a great opportunity to introduce your non-film spotting friends to the show. Maybe they want to participate, join in the madness. They don't have to listen, Michael. They can just go and vote. We'll take that. even though they may have totally unsophisticated opinions about film, it's fine. It's open to anybody. We're egalitarian here on the show.
As you should be.
Use the hashtag FSMadness on Twitter if you are working through the pain of making some of these choices. We'd love to hear about it. You can commiserate with us. Again, that's filmspottingmadness.com. And Michael, that's our show. That's it. We made it through the madness. We survived.
That was fun. It was fun to kind of wrestle with the sacred cow like Casablanca, too.
I agree.
And it was great to get Catherine Fusco in on the conversation.
Absolutely. At filmspotting.net, that's where you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. A host of Sacred Cow reviews. I think we're over 20 at this point. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out in wide release, Michael, why didn't we devote a full 20 minutes to The Boss Baby?
Haven't seen it.
Okay, me neither. Ghost in the Shell. Scarlett Johansson.
Tomorrow night.
You're going to see it.
I'm living in the future. I can't talk about it now. I'm going to see it tomorrow night.
You are. In limited release, The Zookeeper's Wife, set in World War II era Warsaw, a zookeeper and his wife give sanctuary to people during a Nazi invasion. Well, that's the movie we should have paired with Casablanca.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
Jessica Chastain stars. It's directed by Nikki Caro, who gave us Whale Rider. Next week, Josh is back, and we're going to talk about Charlie McDowell's The Discovery. It stars Rooney Mara, Jason Segel, Robert Redford. McDowell is the director of 2014's The One I Love, which starred Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss. That film, Michael, Josh and I had a pretty strident split on. I was a huge fan of that film. Michael, did you see The One I Love?
I did, and I took the only sensible middle course of being just okay with it.
Just okay.
So
I'm sorry.
I would have been the guy saying, Adam, Josh, you're both wrong enough for me to dismiss both your opinions. That's what I would have said.
The Discovery is being released exclusively on Netflix, and it's actually available to stream right now as we're talking, as you're listening to this. So we're hoping maybe we'll get a little bit more engagement with this conversation as you can check it out before we review it. We will have that review plus your Film Spotting Madness Championship contenders, and our Agnes Varda Marathon continues with 1985's Vagabond. For more info about the marathon and how and where to watch the films, please visit our website, filmspotting.net, and click on the Marathons tab. It's right there at the top of the page. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, the show wouldn't go. We thank our associate producer, Candace Griffith, and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information available at WBEZ.org. Michael, it was so much fun to have you back on the show. Thank you for doing this.
It's an honor and a pleasure. Thanks, Adam.
I don't believe you, but I'm going to accept it. I'm going to accept it. Where can listeners find your stuff?
They'd have to find it. They have to find it at chicagotribune.com/movies.
They should follow you on Twitter at Phillips Tribune.
Yes, they should. And also next month on Turner Classic Movies, I'll be introducing 13 post-war melodramas in April.
So, nice. When does that begin?
First week of April, April 6th or 7th. And some interesting stuff, a couple of like 3 Douglas Sirk films and The Best Years of Our Lives. And so that's what I'm doing in April.
If you like listening to Michael Phillips, you'll enjoy looking at him even more.
So
that's what I said.
Did I tell you about the clothes?
No.
So I last time I went down to Atlanta to tape for Turner, they said, you know, the last time you came a couple of years ago, do you remember all those clothes you brought? I said, yeah. I said, don't bring those clothes ever again.
Wardrobe?
Yeah, never. I got a little bit of money to buy a new suit, so you can see my new suit.
I can't wait.
In April. Oh, it's a pip.
You have to wear it next time you come to the studio. I think I'm demanding that.
Right.
For Michael and Josh and Sam and everyone here at Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Oh, I never got to do my Peter Lorre impression.
No, you didn't. But you can do it now.
Okay.
We'll include it.
Okay.
I can't wait to hear it.
Okay.
Go
ready?
For it. Yeah.
Ready? You despise me, don't you, Rick?
Wow.
And then later he says, hide me, Rick, hide me. So that's my Peter Lorre.
Oh, man.
I know. Pretty good, huh?
That is really good.
Oh, man.
When did you first discover you could do a Peter
I think
Lorre?
I worked on that. You know, I remember Tom Johnson, a great friend of mine at the Minnesota Daily in college, you know, just came up with it. And then everyone started. He is, in fact, the easiest guy in Hollywood to do an impression.
Really?
Of.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
You can do it. Try it.
No,
do it.
I'm not.
Just give it a
shot. Nope, I'm not.
Oh, Mr. Uptight
I
Iowa.
I am too uptight.
Ooh, can't do Peter Lorre.
I can't do any voices. You've heard me act.
Well, there must be. I only did it because Josh isn't sitting in this chair.
That's right.
Like usual.
You had to be the ham.
Yeah, see, God knows he would jump right in and give it a shot.
He would. He's much more adventurous.
So that's my Peter Lorre.
I love it.
I can do S.Z. Cuddles Sekal, who's also in Casablanca. S.Z. Sekal.
Who is that?
Plays Carl, right? Carl, the maitre d'.
Oh,
Carl,
of course.
The hair professor.
You can
right?
do it?
He can do a. He used to flap his cheek. You know, like, you know, like Hans Hall would do in the Bowery Boys movies, too. And I can, okay, ready?
Yeah.
Now, that's coming out of the side of my mouth,
the
not
side,
the front.
The side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's Cuddles Sekal. These are
wow.
impressions that Rich Little never bothered with.
No, okay. He didn't.
I don't think so.
Oh, man. That was great. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.